Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Amongst the varied and different reasons of the fall in numbers of people going to Mass lies the obvious conclusion that the Church has been losing the information war with secular society. The onslaught of what we can reasonably call secular propaganda is relentless. It's experienced by our children, in particular through the almost uniformly progressive culture of education, and is amplified by different media platforms. Catechesis, teaching children as well as adults what we believe, why we believe, what difference believing makes, firstly to the individual, then to the Church, and more widely to society, is not the only responsible way to pass on the experience and vibrancy of our faith, but it's essential if we're in a culture war with an antithetic competitor. Stefan Karminski studied philosophy and theology in Rome, pursuing postgraduate specialisation in marriage and family life at the John Paul II Institute. He's director of the Christian Heritage Centre at Stonyhurst, and he runs an imaginative and inspirational programme for young people nearing the end of their schooling, who want to both deepen their faith and learn how they can acquire a vision for the Christian and Catholic renewal of society. Stonyhurst itself, with its history, carries powerful resonances for the Catholic community in this country. Stefan has revitalised and re-energised the Christian Heritage Centre during his time as director, and he joins me now. Stefan, it's lovely to see you. You're way up in the northwest corner of England at the Stonyhurst Centre. And one of the things that you are preparing to do is to run a leadership course for young Catholics. I'd like to ask you a number of questions, both about the Stonyhurst Centre and about you yourself. But just in 60 seconds, can you give a brief synopsis of what are you hoping to achieve and why are you inviting these people on the young leadership course? And then we'll go back to unpack it a bit more towards the end of our conversation. Is that all right?
Yes, of course, Gavin. Fundamentally, we want to achieve, I suppose, the transformation of society tomorrow. We want to re-Christianize a society that has lost God and that has lost everything that flows from that. We want to engage those students, those young people who are on the cusp of leaving school and stepping out into the adult world, with the intellectual tradition of Catholicism, of Christianity, and to give them pointers and markers, reference points, to bring that faith, that thought out faith, into the real world and to transform our society through that.
That's very good. And we're going to come back to it and unpack it a bit, and I'll ask you about previous courses and the kind of people who've come and the experiences. How long is it? When is it? And then, having put that marker down, we'll set off on the rest of our conversation.
Of course, it's a yearly fixture, and it's made up of three residential courses. So it's a total of 14, 15 days of tuition, of input, of community living, of prayer. And those 15 days are divided into 5-6 days in July at the end of year 12, lower sixth form, and then 4 days during the October half term and 4 days during the February half term in year 13, upper sixth. So it accompanies them over 6-9 months of their last year of schooling.
This sounds very interesting. I'm going to slightly change the strategy of our conversation and ask you next about Stonyhurst, and then about you, and then finally about these courses. But Stonyhurst has a reputation in the minds of Catholics and non-Catholics, hardcore Jesuit centre, left-hand side of England where nobody can get at them. I've visited your centre. I think it's a wonderful place, and has a very interesting relationship with the school, of course. I was too far away in the bottom southeast of the corner to play rugby or other sports against Stonyhurst. So we kind of just knew of it as another but Catholic public school up there. And you're in the shadow of it with your centre. Can you tell us a bit about the history of Stonyhurst and then expand into the way in which the school and your centre have emerged into fully fledged life?
Sure. So like you, Gavin, I grew up in London in the southeast, and Stonyhurst was but a name of a place, some slightly esoteric place, I think, where a lucky few went off to school following common entrance exams or whatever it was. It's a place I've probably passed many times on the way up to Scotland, but it's I think for the southerner, it's that corner of England is somewhere that one risks not really knowing, ever coming to know very well. But Stonyhurst has a long and rich history. It was one of the many educational establishments that was set up by the great enterprising Jesuit Father Robert Parsons at the end of the 1500s. So it started life as one of several schools, I suppose, expat schools for Catholic boys to be educated at on the continent, being sent there from by their parents from within Protestant England. And it was set up in Saint-Omer, which is modern-day France, and then was the Spanish Netherlands. So it stayed for about 200-odd years there in Saint-Omer. It had to move to Liège and then Bruges towards the end of the 1700s. And at the end of that century, it had to quit the continent altogether because of Napoleon's activities over there.
The Spanish Netherlands are the top right-hand corner of France. You say that they had to flee Napoleon. What was the impact of the French Revolution on them before that? I mean, clearly a bad 40 years all in all. But did they survive the French Revolution and then have to give way before Napoleon? Or was it a double whammy?
I think that's why they moved progressively, first to Liège and then Bruges. So progressively further north, if I've got my geography correct. Mm-hmm. And I believe that was because of the French Revolution and the pressure that they were coming under and the intolerance that was being experienced there. I think then Napoleon put a complete sort of end to any enterprise being possible within the continent itself in that area. They left, I think, with the idea that they were going back to England merely for a matter of a number of years or at the most a couple of decades before, you know, Monsieur Napoleon's sort of ideas expired and they would be able to return to the continent. And of course, they remained in England. So they settled that on the Stonyhurst estate, which belonged to, at the time, the Well Blundell family, who had links with the college, having educated children there.
What year was that, roughly?
So this is 1794.
Right.
And coming to England from the continent, they brought with them what had become already a significant collection of relics and religious artifacts that had been sent over with the boys, I guess, to the continent to be safeguarded from the Protestant authorities. Amongst those treasures, you have the rope, a part of the rope that bound Edmund Campion to the hurdle as he was dragged from the Tower of London across the streets all the way to Tyburn to be hung, drawn and quartered, which presumably some Catholic pious man managed to filch, and maybe having paid the executioner to turn a blind eye as he picked it up. The prayer book of Mary, Queen of Scots, handed to her lady-in-waiting as she mounted the scaffolding. Various items belonging to St. Thomas More, including the small personal crucifix that he wore under his hair shirt, which has some little sort of pins, points on the back of it, which would have designed to sort of be pressing into his chest to remind him of its presence there. A ring belonging to St. John Fisher. There's a relic of the Crown of Thorns in there, as well as then a number of vestments that were made, very beautiful vestments made by various Catholic recusants, and a whole, you know, host of prayer books and other relics, which altogether tell the story of Catholicism in England, really, for the last 500 years. And then to that have been added artifacts, religious artifacts and other items that have been collected by Jesuit missions from all around the world. So it's sort of also taken on a rather universal dimension through that. But at the core of it is this witness to the faith of Catholics in England, very much a living testimony to that faith. I suppose that's where the charity sort of came into play. It was originally set up by Lord David Alton and another then member of the College Governors, with the intention of being able to raise funds to help support the care, the preservation of the collection, and to make them publicly accessible. So we supported the college, or the charity supported the college in creating a museum, in purchasing display cabinets for these items to be displayed. And that museum is adjacent to the historic libraries in the college. The charity then leased the site of the old mill, which is now Theodore House, which you've been to and stayed at, and built a residential retreat and conference facility there. The idea was very much that would serve as a base, I suppose, for people to be able to come and engage with the collections as well, and that the charity's sort of activities going forward would be somehow tied up with the collections. I came on board after, I suppose, that second phase of the project was complete, Theodore House. And I suppose my vision for Theodore House, given that we are two separate entities and given that the collections are not readily accessible, especially during term time, has been very much to sort of create a Catholic formation project in the shadow and sort of building on the heritage of Stonyhurst and that tradition as both a historic and evocative place, and also a very beautiful place to come away to and be refreshed. Speaking to from one southerner to another, I often remind or stress to people that the distance from London to Stonyhurst is more psychological than real, because it's not a long train ride, assuming that the trains are indeed running, and assuming that the roads from there to Stonyhurst aren't flooded. It's not a complicated journey at all.
Well, at this point, I'm in the unusual position of being able to say, having been to Theodore House and enjoyed your hospitality and engaged in a small conference there, it's just the most marvelous place. And you're quite right. To a southerner, the northwest corner of the country is certainly psychologically inaccessible, but it needn't, as you say, be geographically inaccessible. It's not too difficult to get to. But it is a really wonderful place. The mill and the way you've laid it out, the rooms, the conference center, the facilities you've had, and I hope people don't mind me talking too fondly of your cooks.
it's always an important part.
It's a really wonderful resource, and I can't wait to get back when we're hoping to visit you again in the spring for another conference. But there can't be many educational centres in the Northwest like this for the Catholic Church. Do you have much competition around you?
The short answer to that, I think, is no, really. As an independent sort of Catholic formation project, we're fairly unique, I would say, in the UK. I mean, there aren't many other formation projects or sort of formation centres really left. Merivale obviously offers is on a different plane, offering degrees, but I think it's trimmed down its sort of more lower level, more accessible offering of sort of diplomas and certificates. The School of the Annunciation that was based at Buckfast, of course, has since closed. And I think what was Southwark's Catholic Formation Centre has sort of evolved into a sort of cloud-based, if you want, more sort of parish mission, I think, type activity. Really, the niche that I see is what I call low-level formation. And by low-level, I mean that it's not working towards a certificate or any sort of degree. It's short, it's a few days at the most, and accessible to anyone, you know, to your Catholic, to your average Catholic layperson, whatever that looks like, who has a working life, who doesn't have the time to commit to a systematic year-round, even part-time distance learning course, but wants to come away for a few days, you know, to nourish their intellect or their soul, or preferably both.
So I think it's wonderfully placed. I mean, first of all, it is, as you say, much more accessible. It's also very beautiful. And I mean, there are two kinds of beauty, I thought, when I came. One was the school itself is an extraordinary building and a great testament to Jesuit vision and Catholic missionary resilience. It's just, I mean, architecture has this effect. One has to look at it and say, well, these people really believed in something, and they've produced a wonderful reflection. And at the same time, as you say, to be so close to really such important relics, and although I'm late come to Catholicism, all the relics you've talked about are again deeply moving and highly influential. How did they manage to get you? Because you're really quite, if I may say so, a very well, intellectually well-resourced person. And I mean, I think they're very lucky to have you. So your natural humility is going to make this conversation more difficult, but I'm going to do my best. You bring to this some really high-class intellectual theological skills, don't you? Tell us a bit about your own journey.
Well, thank you, Gavin. That's very kind. I'm not sure to what extent that's true. But nonetheless, I suppose it was all, you know, at the end of the day, it's all God's gift, isn't it? But I had the opportunity to study. I was in seminary for a number of years, so I had the opportunity, I suppose, to enter the pontifical, you know, system, having been sent to Rome. I did a bachelor's in philosophy at the Gregorian University, followed by a sacred theology bachelor's, and that sort of opened the door for the licentiate. So I chose to go and do a license later at the John Paul II Institute for Studies in Marriage and Family Life. And I chose that really partly because John Paul II was the Pope I grew up under. And I certainly wasn't one for, human idols or role models to any sort of significant sense, in which your teenager typically does have people he looks up to and, you know, wants to be like. But John Paul II always inspired me with his greatness of character, really, the greatness of his faith, of his intellect, of his human wisdom, his human, I don't know, persona, his experiences, and the greatness of his vision. within that vision, I was very conscious that, I suppose, the question of human sexuality was one of the pressing ones of our time. I mean, if not of our time necessarily, it's one of the, I do believe it's one of the pressing questions of every human person, every time, because it touches on that most fundamental reality of love and its living out. And so both in my discernment, you know, around or towards or away from the priesthood and the married life, that was the most fundamental question, was, you know, it's not a question of if to love or who to love, because the answer to that is always God, but how to love and how that should be lived. And then more particularly, obviously, the whole question of gender, of the gender theory and the ideology behind that, and the question of how we understand human identity and sexed identity in particular, was clearly becoming the next big thing. I really wanted to find some answers, I suppose, to that whole theme, and to understand that vision that is the Church's, that John Paul II elucidated and elaborated in a very particular way in his pontificate and his writings, because I felt that really was what, you know, was most needed in evangelizing, well, re-evangelizing, let's say, and maybe apologizing also for our faith, and offering young people especially a hope.
Let me put a parenthesis in here. I mean, we're shifting gear a bit, and I'm personally finding this extremely interesting. I'm going to ask you a bit about the political implications of the change in JP2 Family Centre. I don't want to cause you to lose any political friendship. So I'm not going to sure. press you hard on that. But we ought to recognise in passing that there's been a shift.
Yeah.
If I was to ask you, so people are listening to you, it turns out that you're really rather an expert in the whole issue of gender identity. And if you were to sum up the theological topography of what we're dealing with on the conservative side, the conservative Catholic side, and the liberal, more secularized progressive side, could you kind of give us a 5-minute overview of what you think the issues are? Actually, it's much harder to give a 5-minute overview than to give an hour lecture. I'm putting you on the spot. But on the other hand, when you get an expert, it'd be a shame to lose him. So could you just give us an overview of what you think the Church is struggling with? I mean, obviously, when you and I last met, Fiducia Supplicans hadn't happened. And maybe you have views about it, or maybe you have views you don't want to express about it. This is not about putting you on the spot. This is about trying to give people a sense of what a theological overview looks like to somebody who's really rather competent in the area.
Competency and expertise aside, I think the way I would first of all sum up in 5 seconds, let alone 60, the gender ideology, what I believe is perhaps at the core of it, is what I call a rebellion against reality. And if I can expand on that a little bit, as a Catholic, reality is defined by God. Reality is given by God. And from that, in a sense, flows everything else. If reality is given by God, then everything within reality has God's intention behind it as it is created, and is indeed the result of his will. So that begins with ourselves, and the most fundamental reality that the human person has is their body. That is the starting point, both for the process of our own identification in and of ourselves, in that first elementary distinction between me and you, between me and my mother first and father, and in the communication of myself to the world, and in the reception of myself by the world. So the body in that sense is a sacrament. Now, ironically, this is a notion, therefore, that should sit quite readily amongst today's Catholics who I think have perhaps on the one hand a sensitivity to the idea of the sacramentality of creation, because of the sort of questions around the environment, damage to that, and the sort of why we should or shouldn't care for the environment, and the fact of God's work through it. But that of course feeds through to the human as the climax and as the highest order of that reality. So on the one hand, a society that's lost God, that has removed God from, first of all, from the field of knowing, as the Enlightenment really sought to do, and sought to interpret material reality through, I suppose, human ideas, human imposed ideas, that also, in a sense, takes away that sort of highest order of accountability for what is real. It lowers the bar for what is real to the human rather than to the divine and to what's been given by God. On the other hand, perhaps on the sort of the gender sort of front, I don't know if it's fair to say that from the church's point of view, maybe we're struggling a little bit with it, because possibly because it was unexpected in some ways, possibly because it seems at one level so absurd to be questioning the biological, what is a very heavily evidenced biological, neurological for that matter, physical reality, that, you know, that if you look at any nature documentary, is at the heart of the fact of nature's continuation and the life of the natural world outside of the human. You can't escape that. So perhaps we weren't prepared for, and perhaps the church has never been in a position before where it's really had to give account in such a dramatic and way and starting at such a fundamental level of the reality that is so fundamental.
Let me interrupt for a moment, just because you're absolutely right. The way in which post-modernity and third wave feminism and the whole epistemology of the imagination taking precedence over biology has taken almost everyone by surprise. But one of the things that I found as a pre-Catholic, a lot of pre-Catholics think that, you know, the Catholics were obsessed with sex because they had celibacy, they had birth control. These were exaggerated responses to the dangers of sex, which weren't dangerous at all. And then suddenly after Humanae Vitae and after AIDS and after the abortions rack up to the millions, and now you throw in postmodernism and to provide a kind of chaos, it seems to me that this was accidentally lucky for me. But having become a Catholic, as I did so, I thought, good Lord, having written these people off as having an exaggerated and out of touch reaction to sex, they're the only people who have any conversation with it at all. They are the only people who say, if you break the link between sexual pleasure and procreation, the world of recreation is an absolutely terrible world that we now find celebrated in the temple of pornography and the internet. They were the only people saying God's reality is your vocation. And for some people, it's a vocation to be like Christ and to be celibate. And others, it's a vocation to be co-creators within marriage. I've come into the Catholic Church astonished at how competent the theological conversation about sex was. And I had no idea about it from the outside. And one of the things that I want not to happen is for my Catholic theological friends to lose confidence just at the moment when they really ought to be saying, we told you so. We were right. I mean, none of us are right in the sense that we all practice badly. Of course we practice badly. But there is no other philosophical agency in Western culture that has got anywhere as close to being able to say we had a proper assessment after all. Why is that perfectly proper self-congratulation or congratulation in God's revelation? Why is it missing? Has the confidence really been kicked out of the church quite so badly as it seems?
It's difficult to respond to that. I mean, you know, my limited experience is that we have not really had the courage or the will or the desire, for whatever reason, over the last few decades to preach the good news that the church has, that you're pointing to, about human love, about marriage, and about the other ways of living out that vocation. Certainly growing up, you know, as a cradle Catholic, Catholic schools, Catholic parishes, and so on, I didn't really receive any input at all, really, from anywhere on the church's sort of, on the beauty, on the full beauty of the church's view of human sexuality and marriage. At best, a passing, you know, admonition here or there as to what was immoral, what was out of bounds, but nothing more than that. And it seems to me that we lost an opportunity that John Paul II, I think, was prophetic and timely in the catechesis that he gave towards the end of the 70s and the early 80s. Perhaps it still took a few more years for people to sort of appreciate what a treasure he'd left there, but for whatever reason, it wasn't widely received and widely propagated, I guess, in churches across around Western Europe. And so I think the Catholic laity, for the most part in Europe, have been starved of that. They've been under the cosh from the sort of contraceptive abortion lobby. They've been subconsciously sold the lie that our bodies are for us to do with whatever we want, which of course feeds into the whole, you know, the most fundamental level, the whole sort of theory of gender, as indeed the rest of that, the accompanying view of reality, that we can shape it, we can determine what reality is, and we exert, you know, the mind over matter. And we're left with without really that clear vision to strive towards. And you're right that the church has been obsessed with sex, and I would say yes, she is obsessed with sex because she realizes she knows that it is the primal sacrament of communion. It's that the male female union, free, exclusive, permanent, and fruitful union is the primal sort of icon of the Trinity. It is the incarnation of should be the incarnation of you know, an image of the Trinitarian communion.
The church has been right to have a very clear focus of the significance of sex, because if we interpret what's gone on both metaphysically as well as sociologically and philosophically, mm-hmm. the attack on the church has been through sex. I mean, you know, in fact, the attack on humanity, on our whole civilization, has been based not only on sexual profligacy, I would say sexual disorder, and sexual confusion. I mean, profligacy followed by disorder, followed by confusion, followed by anarchy. It's all been about sex when you know, plus a bit of power thrown in. Mm-hmm. So I think, as far as I'm concerned, I'm so glad to be a Catholic, because retrospectively, I want to take some credit for the church in having dealt with this responsibly. I'd very much like to ask you to help me understand the way in which, just at the moment, so I've come to John Paul II's theology of the body late in life. It isn't every Anglican intellectual's first.
I'm not surprised.
It should be. It should be, but it isn't. And just as I've come to it and said to myself, my goodness, this is a profound theological resource, just at this moment, I hear progressive Catholic voices being embarrassed about John Paul II, about the family center in Rome, about the document, and the whole, if you like, fiducia supplicans movement is clearly very shifty about it and wants to replace it. And so you hear critical things about him, and it sounds more like libel or slander than actual reasoned theological reservation. Tell me what you think about the relationship between this new progressive direction that we're finding ourselves having to deal with in the politics and the theology of this last year or two or longer, and the way in which you see it relating to John Paul II's theology of the body. Where do you stand on that spectrum?
I think there's a lot of confusion within the church as well. Maybe part of that confusion results from a not unreasonable desire to bring the world closer to itself, to reach out, to bring people into the church. There are all sorts of pressures that suggest that, not least of all the falling mass attendances, of course, in part one might link to the demographic winter in Europe, but certainly you know, the emptying out of churches and pews, and perhaps, you know, the other side of COVID that's especially been more felt. And so there's certainly an awareness, at least subconsciously, that we're not getting something right. There's something missing. And so perhaps, and maybe this is all just all at the subconscious level, there's a desire to accommodate, to reach, to right what might be perceived as wrongs, rightly or wrongly, in the church's past, and the way it's preached, or in what it has said, or what it has done. Of course, the whole scandals around abuse of children and so on is only, you know, levered to I suppose push church men, those who represent the church, into a greater sense of guilt and shame and need, therefore, I suppose, conversely, to reach out and to sort of make people feel welcome. And I think that is in great part at the heart of it. I wonder too if there isn't some sort of innate need to, I suppose, to fulfill people's sense of needing to belong. I think one of the fundamentally, and I would say the crisis that we face today is one of identity. I think that's at the heart of all of these, and of course it's fundamentally tied in with the whole issue of gender ideology, because identity is wrapped up in our bodies, in who we are as a male or a female. Social boundaries, family boundaries, societal groups, even national groups are being whittled away. And of course, what should give every person on this planet their most profound and their deepest unshakable sense of identity is that of being created in the image of God and being a child of God and loved by him. And from there, in a sense, nothing else should matter. But of course, many people don't have that. And so are sort of needing to be wanting acceptance and clamoring for that. You know, they can only understand acceptance as maybe as belonging to a group, and belonging to a group means, you know, a certain set of preconditions and partaking of certain rituals and so on and so forth. So I don't know within the church whether it's, you know, a combination of that pressure or of a lack of confidence in what the church has to offer in her teaching, fear of being rejected, should we proclaim that too loudly, an attempt to present the church's teaching just using different language or in a different way of trying to sort of smoother off edges. At the end of the day, there's a, you know, while all of that is very understandable, there I think there comes a point where one has to draw the line and one has to accept, and I think if one doesn't accept this, then the danger falls from there, that as Catholics, we are fundamentally on a different page from the secular West. We are operating on different fundamental philosophical premises. We believe that there is an objective moral good, which is called God, and he is a person, and he wishes us to engage in a personal loving relationship with him. The secular West doesn't have such objective moral standards or criteria, for example, to offer us. Many secularists, many atheists will inevitably end up pointing in some way to the need for such moral criteria, for example, but of course they don't have that to offer. You know, it's a little bit the same sort of conundrum as multiculturalism. It's all very well, you know, hosting, promoting, tolerating a multitude of cultures, but at the end of the day, that attitude in of itself doesn't present or constitute a positive framework for your national society, because it's not a framework. It doesn't have a vision, it doesn't have a structure, it doesn't have a set of values to shape that society.
And worse than that, the trajectory, so which has suddenly appeared, really of late, is that this extraordinary phenomenon of transgenderism, which we didn't see coming mainly, has a landing place in what looks like transhumanism. In other words, it seems almost a strategy to divorcing us from our, as you quite rightly described it, our sacramental rootedness in who God has made us to be, in the biological and theological entities of masculine and femininity. And the moment we get divorced from it, it's not just a matter of social convenience as pleasure and pleasure, though it is that, as you quite rightly described it, but it's somehow the prospect of being launched into an utterly relativistic, mechanized future where philosophically we are wholly unrooted and unmade from our given biology, in a becoming prize to an ambition that almost ludicrously, except for sci-fi fanatics, seems destined to give us a different version of eternity, that the living forever of transhumanism, in a way, almost that if one is to try and be philosophically aspirational, almost the sort of the absurd end of the Enlightenment project. I think, therefore, I am. I think is the only way I am, because I've become detached from everything else. So it's not just a slippery slope of growing incoherence. It looks like it's a totally different project. And at that point, Catholics being on a very different page, that's quite a good place to be, isn't it?
I would say so. And yes, I think you're absolutely right. Because at the end of the day, that sort of transhumanist project, I suppose, that Cartesian ideal, I think therefore I am, is one that therefore presupposes that in the material being there is no moral meaning, there is no order, it is all just neutral matter to be manipulated, to be shaped according to one's whim, to one's desire. I mean, at the end of the day, we're dealing with original sin, aren't we? Nothing has changed. Yep. Since the fall.
Right.
It's, you know, it's either God's way or my way. And Adam and Eve chose my way. They wanted to put the moral sort of lay down the moral criteria themselves, and that is, it's innate and it's in our DNA in a sense, isn't it? And as fallen human creatures, we are doing exactly that. And as I said before, transgenderism represents the most radical expression of that. And going back to a point you made earlier, about sort of sex being the point of attack and sex and the family. And of course, Sister Lucia at Fatima, one of her letters to John Paul II, wrote to him saying that Our Lady had warned that the family would be the point of attack on the church, of course, because the family is the building block of society, both society, the national society and the society of the church. It's where new Christians are born and baptized and educated in the faith.
So I want to join in here and jump in again, if I may, and say you originally, one of the things you said earlier on in the conversation, quite rightly, was that there was a lack of catechesis in your generation, and I mean a bit older than you, but and mine too, which left Catholics so vulnerable to the pressing attractions of sugarized secular society. So clearly, one of the answers to the present disastrous cultural war is to catechize Catholics, and above all, children. And that's what you're doing. Presumably, that's the purpose of your leadership program. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure, it is really. I mean, most of our activity as a centre is orientated to adults, but this is where we've sort of stepped below the 18-year-old mark, I suppose, and wanted to pick out those students or engage with those students who at that age are still wanting to deepen their faith, wanting to deepen their understanding of the Catholic vision for the human person and human society, and want to themselves be part of shaping the society of tomorrow. So we want students really to receive grounding in the philosophical and the theological principles that underpin the Catholic vision of society, that underpin the common good. So, for example, we focus particularly on the themes of human dignity, of human rights and civil law in the first of the three modules, which we call the philosophical foundations for the common good. And that, I think that's a great example, because those are all words, especially human rights, that are bandied about so much today. But of course, they have lost the content, the historical sort of content of their meaning, their roots. People claim human rights without having any rationale for that, without understanding where the concept of human rights has come from, where it has been elaborated from, in the Western tradition, beginning with the ancient Greeks, and then through the sort of revelation that Christianity brings to it. So the thrust, in a sense, of the program is intellectual, and then from there we look also at the sort of what I call the human ecology. So bringing into play the Catholic social teaching as principles that flow from those foundational principles that can help structure a fair and a just society, and the way we should structure that society. Its economic fabric. So we look at some basic principles around taxation, around public subsidization, individual responsibility, corporate responsibility. We look at ecology with a focus on the environment on the one hand, and the material home that we have to steward and to care for. We look particularly how that has always been a part of Catholic teaching for a long time, and what a proper sort of respect for that environment looks like. But then within that material creation, we put the emphasis on its peak and its climax, which is the human person and the dignity, the sanctity of human life, and what safeguarding human life, especially at its most vulnerable stages, looks like. We approach that, with not just theological principles, but medical principles. We've got some fantastic lecturers, who themselves span the theological, the medical profession and fields of research. So alongside the intellectual content of the program, we also weave in the personal, the spiritual dimensions. It's a program that wants to offer holistic formation and not just one or other of those different areas. So looking at what the Christian faith has to offer society and the human person, we firmly believe that has to be grounded in a living life of prayer, a living relationship with Christ. At the end of the day, one has to be personally convinced of Christ being the answer to humanity's needs, to humanity's woes, to humanity's desire, in order to you know, to bring those principles to carry them into the public forum. The program is shaped by a liturgical framework: morning prayer, evening prayer, daily mass. We want to introduce the students to all develop their practice of you know, sort of traditional devotions like rosary, Eucharistic adoration, to Lectio Divina, in order to you know, broaden, equip them spiritually. And we also culminate the third module with a very short period of silent retreat, where really the focus is of everything that has come before is brought on to the person of Christ. And Christian leadership, of course, has to find its answer in that person. And alongside those two, the sort of intellectual and spiritual strands, there are the interpersonal skills that we build up in them. We offer a series of workshops training them to engage with the media, their presentation. We give them the opportunity to take a seat in front of a nationally recognized journalist to put their presentation skills to the test. There's a number of team building activities that both have a fun dimension, but also are very much orientated towards building up those communication interpersonal skills. And then there is also an emphasis on the personal development, particularly the virtuous development. Showing them what virtuous leadership looks like. That, of course, has to begin with personal integrity, and off the back of that, how they can help to, you know, how they can be a force for change in a culture. Off the back of that personal integrity, that personal formation, that personal conviction, and putting that into play in society. So it's very much a holistic program, as I say. We've got some fantastic collaborators. We've got professors from St. Mary's University, Twickenham, Warwick University, philosophy lecturers. We've got support from Catholic Voices, who provide the media training, from Alliance Defending Freedom, from the Catholic Union of Great Britain, the Alliance of Pro-Life Students. So all sorts of different people that we can draw on their expertise, you know, academics of serious standing. And of course, the program is endorsed, supported by Lord David Alton, who I suppose is the conceptual origins of the program, and supported by a number of other Catholic public figures who we draw on to give them to present them with their certificates and give them their final sort of presentation, which takes place at the Palace of Westminster Hall.
Well, I'm sorry there's an upper age limit to this, because it sounds very attractive. I would have thought there were a whole load of people who were no longer biologically children who might want to make use of this extraordinary program. It sounds wonderful. If people want, at the end of this podcast, as we draw to a close, we'll try and put some of the links in the show notes. But who do they get in contact with if they want to? Can you give an email or a web address?
ChristianLeadershipFormation.com is the dedicated webpage. And for any inquiries by email, it's just clf@ChristianHeritageCenter.com. So ChristianHeritageCenter.com is the charity's webpage. ChristianLeadershipFormation.com is the program's own dedicated webpage.
Stefan, I hope this gets as wide as possible publicity and platform, because it, in the same way with the beginning, we agreed that it's lack of catechesis and a lack of an understanding of Catholic identity that was underlay the vulnerability of the church to what we've experienced over the last few decades. This sounds like a wonderful antidote. So I'm just sorry I can't sign up. But thank you very much for the conversation. Thanks for explaining it. And I look forward very much to hearing more about its development. Thanks for taking time and trouble for this conversation. It's been really great.
Thank you, Gavin.